Christy Marceau was at her home in Hillcrest, Auckland, New Zealand, when she received a phone call. On the other end of the line was a familiar voice, a man that Christy knew from work. The acquaintance told Christy that he was feeling suicidal. Christy immediately dropped what she was doing and ran to his nearby home. Christy Marceau's place in the family was a cherished one. Born as the second child to Tracy and Brian Marceau, she arrived 6 years after her older sister Heather, giving her parents an unexpected gift they never thought that they would have. Nestled in the Hillcrest neighbourhood of Auckland, New Zealand, the Marceaus led a fulfilling life. Tracy dedicated herself to her role as an accounts assistant, while Brian served as an avionics technician in the Air Force. Following in her father's footsteps, Heather pursued a career in the Air Force, working as a senior supply specialist, stationed in Whānuapai. Christy, on the other hand, immersed herself in academics at AUT University after completing her studies at ACG Parnell College in 2010. Beyond her studies, Christy was an avid hockey player, contributing her talents to one of North Shore's United Seniors women's teams. Coach Mark Patterson spoke fondly of her natural happiness and outgoing nature, describing her as an exceptional team player who effortlessly fostered friendships among her teammates. Cycling also held a special place in Christy's heart. She actively participated in rides and time trials organised by the Auckland Central Cycling Club, showcasing her determination. At the frontier of adulthood, Christy's caring and compassionate nature shone through, and she was always looking out for the underdog. Her parents described her as a beautiful baby who grew into a happy toddler, a mischievous and intelligent child, and a striking teenager with a huge heart and a smile that you couldn't help but be warmed by. Christmas held a special significance for the Marceau family, with festive celebrations bringing them together. Christy in particular embraced the holiday spirit, eagerly taking charge of putting up the Christmas tree and adorning it with decorations each year. Christy lived at home on Eban Avenue with her mother, father and grandmother Shirley, who lived in a downstairs flat in the home. In 2011, Christy found herself working at a local supermarket alongside an acquaintance, 18-year-old Akshay Anand Chand. Their connection stemmed from attending the same primary school for a brief period and living in close proximity. While their interactions were limited to occasional conversations on social media, they were by no means close friends. Chand was categorised as an odd and solitary individual, and was often regarded as an outsider. Christy, however, had shown kindness to him when few others had. Chand had been born in Fiji on the 11th of December 1992, and when he was 4 years old, the family moved to Britain. They remained there until Chand was 9 years old when the family moved to New Zealand. Soon after, his parents separated, and his father returned to Fiji and had very little contact with his son. As a young student, Chand had excelled in school, especially in English and maths. However, he always struggled in social conditions and never really made any friends. As he entered his teenage years, Chand's withdrawal intensified. By 2011, he had experienced academic setbacks, substantial weight loss, and had become increasingly isolated, spending the majority of his time engrossed in video games within the confines of his bedroom. Accounts from those familiar with him revealed his tendency to give away significant sums of money, possibly in an effort to gain companionship. Christy was among the recipients of this generosity. While Chand displayed an obsession with Christy, she regarded him as nothing more than a friend from work. Nevertheless, Chand would linger outside the supermarket, fixated on catching a glimpse of her as she left work. He would often unload lengthy and rambling messages, venting about his life. Despite feeling unsettled, Christy, who was known for her compassionate nature and championing the underdog, tolerated Chan's strange behaviour. She unwittingly became an outlet for his troubles, a person with whom he felt safe confiding without fear of judgment. Over time, Christie's concerns grew as she sensed Chan's deteriorating mental state and apprehended potential harm in his presence. Unbeknownst to Christie, however, by mid-2011, Chan had started hearing voices in his head. Initially, Chan mistook them for his co-workers' conversations beyond earshot. Around the same time, his obsession with Karl Marx and his book, Das Kapital, intensified. He developed a fixation on capitalism and ultimately quit his job, unable to reconcile government spending while witnessing the plight of starving children. On the 6th of September 2011, Christie received a distressing phone call from Chand at her home. He threatened to consume 40 pills mixed in a drink unless she visited him immediately. Christie feared for his safety and responded swiftly. Given the proximity of their residence, she donned her jacket and set out to Chan's home, located just around a kilometre away. As they sat down in his bedroom, the atmosphere shifted and tension filled the air. Christie vividly recalled the harrowing moments that followed. He got really angry, and then he pulled a knife out of his back pocket. He got up and stood over me. His right hand was shaking it as he was waving it. It was a kitchen knife, like one of those ones that you pull out of a knife set. It was about 20 centimetres, and it looked like he'd sharpened it. Chan then told Christie if she screamed or tried to escape and didn't obey him, then he would knife her. She recollected, "When he said that to me, I started crying because I thought he was going to kill me. I've never been so terrified in my life. Then he told me to shut up and compose myself." He told Christie that his aim was to terrify her, get revenge, and then kill himself. He ordered her to strip naked, and she recollected, "I started crying more because I was getting an idea of what he wanted to do." He held the knife out and said, "You know what will happen." So I took them off. Nude, other than for her underwear, Christie found herself seated in an armchair within Chan's bedroom, forced to endure his ramblings. He spoke of an encounter with the devil, claiming that one fateful night he was seized by an unseen force, plunging him into an unwinnable battle. Chan delved into a litany of troubles for the next half hour before uttering, "I'm going to let you go, but I just want you to know that once you leave, I'm going to drink the drink." Christie quickly put on her clothes and discouraged him from taking his own life. She then seized the opportunity to escape and fled from the home and immediately reported her terrifying ordeal to her mother, who in turn called the police. Chand was charged with kidnapping, assault with intent to commit sexual violation, and threatening to do grievous bodily harm. He readily admitted to these offences, but then on the 5th of October, he was granted bail with conditions that included he resided at his mother's home on a 24-hour curfew, and that he not go near Christie's address or associate with her in any way. Chand had written a letter to the judge expressing remorse over his actions. It read in part, "Given the chance, I will apologise to her, her parents and anyone else affected. Ironically, the last thing she said to me was that she was sorry. It's only after the events of that day that she realised how much pain depression caused me and how much I needed her and vice versa." Both the police and Christie vehemently opposed to Chan's release on bail, especially due to his proximity to the family's home. In a heartfelt letter to the judge, Christie pleaded with him not to grant bail, fearing for her safety and dreading the prospect that he could attempt to attack her again as revenge. Despite the oppositions, Judge David McNaughton approved the bail anyway. When Chand returned home, his mother hid all of the kitchen knives out of fear that he would harm himself or somebody else. His sister recollected, "I knew what he had done and it terrified me. I remember putting even the small knives away. We did this because we were both scared about what he might do. I took every opportunity to stay at friends' houses so I didn't have to be at home." Chan's mother, Suchita, grew increasingly concerned about her son's well-being and decided to seek assistance for him. After his release on bail, she accompanied him to their family doctor on two separate occasions, hoping to find a solution. However, the visits proved insufficient in improving Chan's condition. Determined to help her son, Suchita took him to Dr. A.J. McCall, a renowned practitioner at the Byron Medical Center. Following a thorough investigation, Dr. McCall prescribed Chan the dosage of 20 milligrams of citalopram, an antidepressant. Disappointingly, however, this medication yielded little improvement, prompting Suchita to revisit the doctor and have the prescription increased to 30 milligrams. In the aftermath of the terrifying ordeal, Christy underwent a profound transformation, becoming a mere shadow of her former self. Though outwardly still projecting an aura of happiness and lightheartedness, beneath the surface she harbored a deep-seated fear. Recollecting the aftermath, her mother Tracy stated, "The greatest impact, though, is that from the day of the offending, I was robbed of my daughter. She became closed, distant, and untrusting." The fear that Christy felt was only exacerbated by the fact that Chan was on bail and lived only around the corner. By November, Christy eagerly anticipated a turning point in her life. Both she and her mother Tracy had plans to fly to Adelaide, Australia, and reunite with Brian, who had just recently secured employment in the area. Brian had already made the trip ahead of them to make the necessary arrangements. The impending move brought a surge of excitement for Christy as she looked forward to attending university in Adelaide. For Christy, the 11th of November couldn't arrive soon enough. On this highly anticipated date, she and her mother were scheduled to embark on their flight, marking the long-awaited moment when Christy would finally sever all ties with Chand, once and for all. At about 6:30 a.m. on the morning of the 7th of November, Chand awoke, climbed out of bed and brushed his hair. He went to his closet where he had stashed a bag which contained a large butcher knife and a hammer. At the time, his mother was at work and his sister was fast asleep. From here, he walked the less than 5-minute walk to Christie's home, listening to Up the Ladder by Radiohead on his iPod, which was on loop. He knocked on the front door and Tracy opened up. Chan stood there for a second, and then reached into his bag and pulled out the butcher knife. As soon as Tracy caught sight of the knife, she began to scream. Chan pushed past Tracy and demanded to know who was in the home. Tracy bluffed and said that Brian was in another room. Seconds later, however, Christy appeared at the top of the stairs that led down to her bedroom, having been awoken by her mother screaming. She saw Chan standing there with the knife in his hand and began to scream. Chan rushed at her and kicked her full force in the stomach, causing her to fall backwards down the stairs. Christy managed to get back up on her feet and scrambled out of the back door, but Chan was close behind her. Tracy ran to call 111 for assistance while Christy ran to the back garden. She attempted to unlock the gate to put some distance between her and Chand. He stabbed her once in the face, and then continued stabbing her in the head, neck, and torso, as her screams echoed up and down the neighbourhood. Christy was stabbed around 10 times by Chand, and had been stabbed with such force that the knife was bent 90 degrees. Despite this, Chand kept trying to stab her, before finally stopping when he realised that the knife was unusable. Seconds later, Tracy emerged from the home. She ran to her daughter's side and cradled her in her arms as her breath became fainter and fainter. Tracy begged her daughter to hold on and that help was on the way. She recollected, "I watched the life drain out of her while I was holding her. I felt her slip away from me." Officers responded to the scene in a matter of minutes, but when they arrived, it was already too late for Christy. She was dead. Jand was just standing there, listening to Radiohead on his iPod, covered in blood with a smirk on his face and the bent knife in his hand. One of the officers later commented that it looked as though he had achieved his purpose. He was asked by one of the officers why he was there, and he calmly responded, "Reprisal." He then began to shake, and when an officer asked why he was shaking, he replied, "It's not easy to kill someone, is it?" Chand was immediately arrested at the scene and was reported to be devoid of emotion. He told the officers that he was a callous fiend, before adding, "That's just who I am. I murdered her." In the face of unspeakable tragedy, Tracy shouldered the arduous burden of informing her husband, thousands of miles away in Adelaide, of the heart-wrenching news. Swiftly arranging for a return flight, he embarked on a long, solitary journey. Reflecting on those hours, he confessed, "It was a long journey, and no one wants to be sitting in a row of seats with some sobbing bastard, so I just kept it all to myself. I certainly don't feel the pain Tracy felt because she was there, but there's still that guilt about not being able to be there." The day after the murder, Chan appeared in court where he was charged with Christie's murder. He was wearing a blue boiler suit and stood silently in the dock. There were several reporters in the courtroom, and Chan's defence attorney, Mary Ann Lowe, attempted to block some reporters from taking photographs of her client. She said that publishing photographs of him would be a threat to his ongoing mental health issues. Judge David Burns responded and told her that it was in the public interest to publish photographs of Chan. Defence attorney Lowe didn't apply for bail, nor did she seek name suppression for her client, who was remanded in custody until the 29th of November. While Chan didn't apply for bail, detectives had prepared an opposition form in the event that he tried. It read in part, "The defendant has stated that he feels absolutely no remorse for the victim, and she deserved to die because she let me down. When he was previously bailed in October, he took this opportunity to carefully plan and execute the murder of the victim. The victim involved in the initial charges is now dead at the hands of the defendant. Chand admitted killing Christy from day one and has never denied any of the facts. The Marshall family have chosen not to speak about the case until Chand is sentenced. They were in court yesterday and heard every detail of Christy's death and the lead up to the tragedy discussed at great length. In the days after Christy's murder, tributes came flooding in from her loved ones. Boyfriend Joseph, who she had been dating for around a month, posted a poignant tribute to her on Facebook. He posted photographs of them together along with the caption, 'Please don't forget me, and please come back.' Afterwards, he and Christy's family released a statement which read in part, 'I'm sure you will all understand that at this emotional time, my family and I, along with all of the Marshall family, just need space and privacy to grieve over the sudden loss of Christy. To all of Christy's friends out there, please stay strong and hold tight to all those happy memories we have of an amazing young woman who we've lost too soon.' The statement also asked those who knew Christy to remember her for who she was and to hold on to those happy memories." On the 13th of November, Christy was laid to rest in Albany. Outside the chapel, personnel from the New Zealand Air Force, where Brian had worked, formed a guard of honour. The service was a non-religious service, during which Christy was described as vivacious, outgoing, friendly, and very fond of animals. Five of Christy's friends made poignant eulogies while her family released a public notice which read, "A bright light taken too early from us. Sleep well, my darling. Your beauty and vivaciousness will be sorely missed and never forgotten." As soon as details regarding Chan's previous attack on Christy were made public, there was a massive outcry, as well as fresh questions about bail legislation and whether tighter laws could prevent such tragedies from happening. The concept of bail is deeply entrenched in the fundamental principles of the legal system. It stems from the notion that every person is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and innocent people are not held in custody. In New Zealand, the approach to bail stands in stark contrast to the United States, where bail amounts tend to be exorbitant, aiming to ensure the accused appearance in court. However, it became evident that serious flaws plagued the administration of bail in New Zealand. Far too often, judges appear to prioritise the rights of the accused, allowing them to remain at liberty while awaiting the resolution to their legal proceedings, often overshadowing the rights of the victims. The presumption of innocence, while a crucial pillar of justice, does not equate to an unconditional get-out-of-jail card. Its scope is not boundless, and it should not come at the expense of safeguarding potential victims. The unsettling realization that the system seemed to prioritize the accused rights over the safety of potential victims called for a crucial examination of the bail process. The tragic consequences that unfolded in Christie's case underscored the urgent need for a revaluation of bail laws, ensuring a delicate balance between the presumption of innocence and protecting the well-being of society. On the 28th of November, Chan appeared in court once more, where he was remanded in custody until the 21st of December. After his appearance, Tracy and Brian spoke with the media for the first time since Christie was killed. They shared their plans to start a campaign called Christie's Law that would toughen bail laws in an effort to prevent other families from going through what they were currently going through. They were working alongside Sensible Sensing Trust and a group of friends to bring their ideas to fruition. Tracy stated, "This is the only thing keeping us going. Nothing is going to bring Christie back to us, but we need to do this for her." They shared their grief, and Tracy said that she was feeling immense guilt over what had happened. She stated, "I will never forgive myself. I have to live with that forever, for the rest of my life. I know it's not my fault, but it still goes through my mind. It's all I ever think about. Nothing would have changed the outcome. I know that now. Everyone says I should be glad that I was there with her. But we should never have had to go through that. We should have been safe. We shouldn't be dealing with this." Tracy and Brian began campaigning for a change in the law. They wanted the criteria for granting bail to people charged with serious offences to be stricter, give more power and weight to police and victim statements opposing bail, and enforce more rigorous risk assessment testing for offenders. They also wanted victims to be given full details of their attacker's bail conditions. Garth McVicker, the director of Sensible Sensing Trust, said that Christie needed to be the catalyst for change. He also said that current bail laws favoured the accused rather than the victim. He stated, "We have a criminal-friendly legal process rather than a justice system. That has to change. We all have the right to live in safety. These people have been failed by the system. It's unbearable from their perspective." In February the following year, Tracy and Brian were ready to launch Christie's Law. The launch took place outside the High Court in Auckland, and they asked everybody in attendance to wear turquoise, which was Christie's favourite colour, to pay tribute to her. Around 500 people gathered to demand tougher bail laws, and they brandished signs such as, "Judges must be held accountable," and "Who's next?" Tracy and Brian weren't the only family members bereaved by violence in attendance. Charlie Borrell was also there, whose son, Augustine, was killed in 2007 by Hayden Davis, who was out on bail. Robin Hanson was there as well, whose niece's mother, Vanessa Pickering, was murdered by Malcolm Cheston, who was also out on bail. Charlie stated, "There are some real dumb laws. We all thought that this stuff wouldn't happen to us, but believe me, you're not immune. This stuff could happen to you next." After the speeches, the crowd marched from the High Court to Britomart. Labour and National were both backing Christie's Law, with Prime Minister John Key announcing that the government had campaigned on tougher bail laws the previous November, and that a bill would soon be introduced to Parliament. After the first reading, it would go to a select committee for public submissions, which would give Christie's law campaigners the chance to put their case to MPs. As Tracy and Brian were fighting for a change, in April it was announced that Cham was ordered to undergo a psychiatric examination. He was remanded to Mason Clinic for 2 weeks, so the assessors could prepare reports on his mental health and fitness to stand trial. He was ruled fit to stand trial and he pleaded not guilty to Christie's murder. It was also announced that he was facing further charges of threatening Christie with grievous bodily harm and assaulting her with intent to commit sexual violence. These related to the earlier kidnapping incident. He pleaded not guilty to these charges as well and lodged an application to have separate trials, one for the murder charge and another for the remaining charges. It was a request that deeply upset Christie's family, as it meant that they would need to attend 2 trials. As Tracy said, "The thought makes me feel really sick. It's going to bring up memories that my counsellors and doctors have been working so hard to relieve. Now I've basically got to start from scratch again. I've started to reach a point in my life where I was dealing with these things. Now I've got to relive those last moments of Christie's life. To be honest, I don't know how I'm going to deal with that." Despite the competency ruling, Chand was going to use an insanity defence when he went on trial. Moreover, it was then decided that Chand would be facing 1 trial for all the charges. In a noteworthy development, a bill aimed at imposing stricter conditions for granting bail to serious offenders was presented in Parliament during its inaugural reading in May. The bill, which gained momentum following the launch of Christie's Law, required individuals facing charges of severe violent crimes, sexual offences or Class A felony drug offences to demonstrate to the Crown that their release would not pose a threat to public safety. Towards the end of the month, Tracy took her case to Parliament, submitting a petition adorned with 58,000 signatures in support of Christie's Law. Additionally, she appealed for the renaming of the aforementioned bill to Christie's Law, asserting that a mere numerical reference lacked the significance and commemoration that a victim deserved. Tracy emphasised, "An amendment number holds no meaning. By renaming it, she and those who came before her will forever be remembered and honoured for their sacrifice." Alarming statistics revealed that over a span of 5 years, 23 individuals were convicted of murders committed while on bail, with an additional 21 found guilty of homicide-related offences committed during their release. These offences encompassed manslaughter, attempted murder, and driving causing death. Shockingly, nearly 70,000 offenders committed new crimes subsequent to their release on bail. In September, Chand made a court appearance pleading guilty to charges of kidnapping Christie, making threats of grievous bodily harm and intending to sexually violate her. This change in plea occurred following psychological assessments, which concluded that at the time of the abduction, Chand did not definitively meet the legal criteria for insanity. If you're a fan of enthralling mysteries filled with unexpected twists, then look no further than June's Journey. This captivating game offers a perfect blend of intrigue and classic whodunit elements. In June's Journey, you'll team up with the charismatic amateur detective June Parker as you delve into a quest to unravel the truth behind her sister's tragic murder and unravel some long-held family secrets. With meticulously crafted scenes, numbering over 1,000, your keen observation skills will be put to the test as you search for concealed clues and vital information. Immerse yourself in the opulence and allure of the 1920s thanks to June's Journey's stunning graphics and captivating gameplay. Personally, I've been captivated by this mobile puzzle game for well over a year, often finding myself absorbed until the late hours of the night, using it as a way to unwind and relax before bed. A standout feature of June's Journey is the ability to personalise your very own island estate and collaborate with a detective club where you can join forces with like-minded sleuths. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free on iOS and Android. The subsequent month saw Chand return to court for sentencing. Prior to delivering the sentence, Judge Helen Winkleman acknowledged the immense impact of his actions, not only on Christy, but also on her entire family, who still grappled with fear for their safety, despite having relocated to Australia. Judge Winkleman remarked, "Your intention was to terrorise Christy, and you succeeded." Initially considering a starting point of 5 years, the judge subsequently deduced 2 years from the sentence, taking into account Chan's clean record, his mental illness, and his guilty plea. Consequently, Chan received a 3-year sentence with the stipulation that he serve as a special patient in a secure mental health facility. However, during the sentencing proceedings, it was revealed that Chan's plea of insanity for Christie's murder had been accepted. Two psychiatric experts, one appointed by the defence and another by the prosecution, had examined Chan and independently concluded that he suffered from schizophrenic psychosis at the time of the murder, with a bleak prospect of recovery. Chan's mental state had deteriorated drastically, transforming a once healthy and intelligent young man into someone plagued by delusions. He firmly believed that he had cervical cancer, and claimed to hear the voice of a girl named Pauline in his head, who commanded him to kill Christy, who he believed to be possessed by the devil. Furthermore, Chand admitted that the letter he wrote to the judge appealing for bail in the kidnapping case was merely a ploy to secure his release from jail so that he could execute his plan to end Christy's life, a plan he had formulated while incarcerated. Following Chan's arrest, he divulged to detectives that he had knowledge of an acquaintance planning to commit 2 additional murders, but he refused to disclose the person's identity. However, in a subsequent interview, he revealed that the acquaintance was none other than Pauline, the voice inside his head. The psychiatric experts assigned to evaluate Chand concluded that his actions were influenced by schizophrenic psychosis, rendering him unaware of the moral wrongness of his deeds. Professor Graham Melsop, who examined Chan, attested to the authenticity of his insanity, stating, "If you had Sigmund Freud and Richard Burton rolled into one, they could not have portrayed schizophrenia as convincingly." Dr. David Chaplow, who was hired by the defence, further affirmed that Chan lacked moral comprehension and insight into his culpability at the time of the crime. Upon acceptance of the insanity plea, Justice Winkleman ordered Chan's detention in a secure psychiatric facility for treatment. He would remain detained until the Minister of Health deemed him no longer a public threat. Prosecutor Simon Moore made it clear that the insanity verdict should not be misconstrued as Chan getting off lightly. He emphasised that the detention was indefinite, with no specified end, and the sole condition for his release was the Minister of Health's satisfaction that Chan no longer posed a risk to the public. Moore stressed the absence of winners in this deeply tragic case, stating, "At every level, this is a desperately tragic case. It's horrible, and nobody can leave the courtroom feeling like it's a great outcome. But under the circumstances, it's probably the best resolution we could have reached." In the aftermath of the determination that Chand was not guilty by reason of insanity, Christy's family experienced profound devastation. They maintained their conviction that Chand was indeed a murderer, regardless of the verdict. Brian expressed their anguish, stating, "To us, he will always be Christy's murderer, and in our eyes, he will always be guilty. I can't reconcile somebody being both guilty and not guilty at the same time." Undeterred, the family vowed to persist in their crusade to hold judges accountable and advocate for stricter bail laws. Tracy asserted, "We firmly believe that Christy should still be with us. She should be alive. Given all that has transpired in court over the past couple of days, it strongly suggests that she was unjustly taken away from us." In 2013, a shocking revelation emerged regarding Judge McNaughton, the judge who granted bail to Chant. It was uncovered that he had not been given the option of electronic bail, despite instructions from another judge to assess its suitability for Chant. The procedure for electronic bail involves defendants wearing electronic bracelets that trigger an alarm with the police if they venture beyond designated areas. Had Chand been granted electronic bail, his departure from the home that fateful morning would have alerted the authorities immediately. Judge Barbara Morris, who had originally denied Chand's bail, had specifically requested a psychiatric assessment for him and recommended medication before considering bail again. However, court staff neglected to follow up on her request, and the transcript documenting her instruction was never sent. During the same year, Tracy expressed her dismay to Justice Minister Judith Collins over the protracted process of amending the Bail Act. Collins assured her that bolstering bail laws remained a priority, and that the Bail Amendment Act had passed the Select Committee stage, awaiting its second reading in Parliament. This legislative effort was notably prompted by the introduction of Christie's Law. On the 29th of August 2013, the Bail Amendment Act finally passed into law with an overwhelming majority of 102 votes to 19. The legislation mandated that individuals facing murder charges or multiple charges related to violence, drugs or sex must convince a judge that their release would not jeopardise public safety. The passage of this bill was directly influenced by the advocacy surrounding Christie's Law. Then in December of that year, Chand became eligible for parole after serving his 3-year sentence for the kidnapping charge. However, his parole was denied by the parole board, citing his continued risk to community safety. While acknowledging his progress in addressing paranoid schizophrenia, the board still noted that he was not yet symptom-free, and still in the early stages of comprehending the connections between his illness, personality, and criminal behaviour. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that a coroner's inquest was finally being held to look into the murder of Christie. The purpose of such an inquest is to investigate the wider circumstances surrounding a death, to see whether something could have been done to prevent something similar happening again. The start of the inquest faced substantial delays, leaving Christie's family in a state of uncertainty and anguish. Tracy expressed their ongoing struggle and stated, "We have never grieved properly because we know that we still have to reface the trauma of the day that Christie was killed at an inquest. The delays are cruel and have caused us great physical and emotional harm." Finally, in June of 2017, the much-awaited inquest commenced, allowing Tracy and Brian to deliver emotionally charged testimonies that shed light on the miscommunication leading to Chan's bail. Tracy revealed that prior to his release, court advisor Andrea Swagger had called her, indicating that Chand was likely to be granted bail. The absence of electronic monitoring upon his release left her devastated, and Christie was left terrified. Brian took the stand next, recounting his conversation with Detective Aaron Armonger, the lead detective in the case. Brian shared, "He assured Tracy and me that police patrols were making frequent visits to Chand's bail address to ensure the restrictions were being complied with. I admit that I believed this statement and the actions of the police were a deterrent. This obviously was not the case. I regret not being more critical and questioning how they could be so sure that the police were providing a secure cordon." The court also heard evidence regarding Judge Morris's request for electronic monitoring, but court manager Kyle Loons testified that it was unclear whether Judge McNaughton, who granted Chand bail without monitoring, had access to the decision during Chan's subsequent bail hearing. Senior police prosecutor Adam Pell testified next and told the courtroom he was concerned to learn that Chand was going to be granted bail. He had vigorously opposed to his release after he heard Chan's admissions to police that he wanted revenge against Christie because he felt as though she had wronged him. He was so concerned about the prospect of Chand being freed that he spoke with the officers in charge of the case to request the full details of Chand's statements be made available to prosecutors for the purpose of opposing bail. In an email to Detective Armonger, he stated, I'm just curious as to how on earth someone with admissions with these kind of charges could possibly be bailed to that address. Detective Ironmonger testified next. He said he advised Tracy to be vigilant, to keep the doors locked, and make the rest of the home secure. He commented, even though Chand was on curfew, he could probably still get there before police. He said that as soon as he was made aware that Chand was granted bail with relaxed conditions, he called up Tracy to apologise. According to Sergeant Rona Stace, the police prosecutor in charge of Chand's file, Judge McNaughton was seemingly disinterested in police's concerns about Chand's bail. She said that she was not given the opportunity to outline the police position on bail, and essentially, it was simply granted. She said the judge was more focused on Chand's treatment and the ability of mental health services to manage him at home. Startling revelations emerged during the inquest, shedding light on the mishandling of Chand's case both before and after his arrest. One crucial detail that surfaced was the exclusion of psychiatrist Ian Goodwin's report from the court file, despite his examination of Chand following the kidnapping incident. Dr. Goodwin's report, which branded Chand as a textbook psychopath with no prospects of being granted bail, mysteriously failed to make its way into the court records. While Dr. Goodwin's assessment focused on Chand's fitness to stand trial rather than his eligibility for bail, forensic nurse Ellen Wilson testified that she felt compelled to hurriedly complete her assessment as Chand's first hearing on the kidnapping charge loomed. Regrettably, her report did not reach the judge in time due to time constraints. Suchita, Chand's mother, also testified during the inquest. She expressed her lack of awareness regarding the conditions of her son's bail. She claimed that she had not been consulted regarding her ability or willingness to supervise him if he were to be released on bail to live at their home. Sharing her frustration, she stated, "Neither the court nor the police provided me with any information about the bail conditions or what was expected of me while Chand was still at home on bail. At no time I was given to understand that I had a responsibility to ensure that Chand was supervised by an adult at my home 24/7. Because of my work commitments, there's no way I could have done that." The inquest laid bare a series of errors in Chand's handling, including crucial omissions from the case file and the failure to bring important information to the attention of Judge McNaughton. Had these details been included, there is a strong possibility that bail would have been denied. Upon the conclusion of the inquest, Coroner Catherine Gregg released her findings, calling for immediate action. She recommended that the chief executives of the Ministry of Justice and Corrections, along with the police commissioner, engage in consultations with key stakeholders to establish guidelines for bail applications involving serious offences, particularly those warranting a 24-hour curfew. The aim was to ensure that evidence was presented to the court in a comprehensive and appropriate format for all similar applications. Additionally, she advocated for potential legislative amendments to be considered within the framework of these consultations, emphasising the need for systemic changes to prevent similar oversights in the future. Another issue examined in the findings was Chand's psychotic state around the time of the murder, which had eluded clinicians despite a dozen mental health checks. The coroner was satisfied that on the 12 occasions Chand was seen by a mental health professional in the lead-up to the murder, he was appropriately assessed for psychosis. The issue was that Chand never admitted to the symptoms he was experiencing. She wrote, "It is clear only with hindsight that Mr. Chand was so terribly dangerous to Christie because of his psychiatric condition." In August of 2007, it was reported in the media that Chand had been spotted in fast food restaurants and shops. He had been quietly granted escorted outings, and Christie's family hadn't even been made aware. After he was spotted by members of the public, the health board confirmed that he had been recently allowed escorted outings. It was devastating to Christie's family, who were assured that if he were ever granted leave, they would have been notified. However, there was a loophole in the Victims' Rights Act, which meant that legally, they only needed to be notified when the leave was unescorted, Tracy commented. After everything we have been through, this is another kick in the face. He's out there, and people need to be extremely, extremely vigilant. I do believe that he is extremely dangerous. The story of Christy Marchaux is a poignant tragedy that reverberates on multiple levels. It lays bare the glaring flaws within New Zealand's bail system that often put the perpetrator above the victim, but also shed light on the grave consequences of untreated mental illness. In the wake of Christy's death, however, her parents embarked on a battle for justice, leading to a pivotal change in legislation. Through this transformative change, there emerges a glimmer of hope that the fate that befell Christy shall hopefully not befall another innocent victim. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my newest supporters up on Patreon, Shannon, Jordan, and Emily. The support seriously goes such a long way, and I am eternally grateful. If you'd like to support this one-woman show, the link to Patreon is in the show notes. In exchange for your support, I upload bonus episodes of Morbidology Plus that aren't on the regular podcast platforms. I also upload ad-free and early release episodes, behind the scenes which includes bonus audio, videos and case files, and I also send out a handwritten thank you card and some merch, including stickers, t-shirts, pins, badges, keychains and fridge magnets. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
Hello, twisted humans. Do you find yourself wanting to know more about the latest murder, conspiracy, cult, or haunting?
Then this is the podcast for you.
In 1952, there was a record high of UFOs reported. 1,500 sightings.
There has been evidence of human sacrifice, devil worship, and it is haunted by more spirits than can be counted.
A family of two adults and two kids reportedly saw a giant flying thing with glowing red eyes.
And meanwhile, the family's nanny that helped Veronica to care for her and Lucian's children was found bludgeoned to death in the basement of their family home.
I'm Alicia.
And I'm Sierra. And this is
Twisted and Uncorked.